Okay, folks, Elvin Shamroth here, and welcome again to our teleconference. We've lost a quarter of our audience because the exam was already, one of the weeks of exams has already happened. So we're down in number, but that's absolutely fine, no problem at all. Even at this late date, we still have people that are joining in for the first time, especially people who came to one of our courses and only became aware of these things very recently, as recently as last week. So for that reason, just briefly, we have three volunteers today with some questions. I've just had a very quick look at those questions, which were sent to me via email earlier today. And what I've done is those three people will be unmuted, and everyone else is muted out because you can't have a conversation with the background noise of several dozen people listening in. So I've got the questions, the cases, I should say, the issues, and we'll discuss them. Other than that, it's totally unscripted. I don't know where it's going to go, but we'll see where this takes us. So let's get right on with it. Miriam, are you there? You're the first person that's on my list. Miriam, are you there? I don't hear Miriam. That's okay. We can still deal with her questions. Melody, are you there? Melody, I don't hear Melody. Okay, this is going to be interesting. Zachary, are you there by any chance? Zachary? I feel like I've got a drive-by candidate's hold on the teleconference today. They put their names up, but didn't come in. They just moved on. Anyway, it's not the end of the world. Maybe they'll come and join us very shortly. I think there is value, nevertheless, in going through some of the issues that were raised. So I'm just briefly, these three candidates can check out the archives. So I'll mention Miriam posted two questions. It wasn't a case. She just had two questions, and one of which I'm going to answer. The first question was, what are the risks of short interval pregnancy, or short inter-pregnancy interval is probably a better way to put it. And I like this question because any of you who have high parity, especially, but also to some extent high gravida patients who are relatively young, you may statistically more likely be in the realm of shortened inter-pregnancy interval. So if you've got a high parity, youngish patient, this certainly is something that you want to be able to talk about. So just go through your cases and see if it's relevant for you. I'm sure many of you, in fact, have such a case on your list, and you may not even realize it. So firstly, the definition, and she asked, what are the risks of short interval pregnancy? That's her question. And I actually don't, I generally don't like to answer these questions because this is pure OB knowledge. I prefer to answer issues of how to present cases. That's really my forte. But I'll answer this briefly. The definition, by the way, of shortened interpregnancy interval, it can vary from 3 to 18 months. Most texts would refer to it as an interpregnancy interval of 6 or maybe 9 months. That's typical, but it varies, obviously. And some of the things that are, some of the complications associated with this are perhaps most commonly anemia, but also premature preterm rupture of membranes, preeclampsia, abruption. There's also a slightly increased incidence of congenital anomaly and decreased birth weight or SGA. So I just wanted to mention that list and be able to, in the exam, say one sentence on this issue if you got one of these cases on your list. Miriam also asked, how do you manage DIC, at the time of cesarean delivery. This is a much bigger discussion. It's far more involved. It's not really for this type of presentation. So I'm going to decline to answer that, Miriam. Please forgive me. But this is not the best place to have that kind of a conversation. You can probably look this up. Hold on a second. I just got a message from... On WhatsApp, I just got a message from Karina in the office. I just want to read what she said. Maybe you can't hear me. Let me see. Oh, I've muted the candidates on the hot seat. Ooh la la. So how do I undo that? Bear with me one second. Okay. So for the record, Karina, you're obviously listening in. And I didn't mute them. I think they probably dialed in with the wrong number. Folks, I'm going to consequently open it up to everyone. I'm going to unmute everyone, okay? Now, because of this, there's going to be a lot of background noise. I have to ask each and every one of you to please make sure there's absolute quiet in the room where you're speaking, otherwise we're just not going to be able to hear each other. So please, if you can take care of that, and I'm going to unmute people now.
Dr. Shamrock, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear. Who is that?
It's me, Karina. Okay, so...
Karina, yes, I got you, yeah.
Miriam and Zachary, and Melody, they're all waiting, okay?
Okay, great, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it, Karina.
Right.
And thanks
Take
for
care.
The message.
Okay.
All right,
bye-bye.
So Miriam, sure thing. Miriam, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, and I actually have
okay.
A case for one of the questions.
So go ahead and so I just was going to get just to finish off. I've discussed the shortened interpregnancy interval, and I'm not going to address in this forum the DIC issue. But do you have another question that you've got for me?
Well, I have a case for a patient who had postpartum hemorrhage from an abruption and went into DIC. So would it be okay if I
mm-hmm.
present the case and then you could ask questions that examiners may ask?
Sure, go ahead. Present it as briefly as you can.
Okay, this is a 39-year-old G5P4, 37 weeks and 5 days, who presented in labor and then had a Category 2 fetal heart tracing with a prolonged deceleration. And the placental abruption underwent primary cesarean delivery and went into disseminated intravascular coagulation with a postpartum hemorrhage and EBL 1500. And she received uterotonics and multiple blood products.
Okay, so look, is any specific? So far, you've shared with us a typical case of probably moderate PPH. Was there anything particular about this case in addition to what you've already shared, or was that the gist of it?
On the cases I wrote out, which received so for 2 units of red cells, 2 units of platelets, 2 units of cryo, and 1 of
Why? Okay, folks, please try and cut out the background noise if you can. Okay, so look, this, Miriam, this case is, in fact, from the exam point of view, the classical PPH case. And this is a favorite question in any OBGYN board exam. Every single one of you have to be able to speak to this. And those of you who attended our course, we dealt with this issue in great detail. I want to encourage you, as you think about the management of PPH, because that's where the conversation is going to go, think of it in terms of mechanical treatment, which are things like uterine compression, bimanual compression, uterine massage, suturing up of lacerations, you know, small vaginal cervical lacerations. Then there's medical management, which is things like prostaglandin, ergometrin, and Pitocin. Then there's hematological management, which is a conversation on blood products and blood component therapy. And then finally, there's surgical management, which is putting in balloons, DNCs, you know, C-hists, all that kind of jazz. So that's the classical PPH conversation. There's nothing specific here, and I would encourage each and every one of you to know this well. Miriam, I haven't really addressed your case specifically, because I think it does fall into the classical scenario of a PPH patient. But with that very broad outline, if you can present it that way, and no blood component therapy well, by the way, would you be comfortable with that, or is there any follow-up question you've got for me?
No particular question.
Say again, sorry?
No, I don't have a particular question.
Okay. It's a standard PPH case. And, yeah, you got all of you need to know this well. Okay. Melody, you're there, yes? Say hello. Can I hear you?
Hi, Dr. Sharon. Yes, how are you?
Hi there, Melody. I'm well, thank you. Yourself?
I'm great, thank you.
Good. So listen, you wrote out a case for me to take a look at. I've got it in front of me in the email that you sent me, but for everyone listening in, I want you to just present it very quickly, and then we can talk about it.
Sure. So this patient's a 30-year-old G2P2. She had an uncomplicated pregnancy and vaginal delivery at 39 weeks. She presented.
I want to interrupt you for a second. Because I know what's coming because I've seen it on the email. But to everyone listening in, she presented her as a 30-year-old G2P2. I just want to emphasize, it's 95%+ of candidates will speak to the para and gravida status of any patient in OB as the antepartum status. So it's typically a gravida 2, para 1. Okay? She presented a gravida 2, para 2 because this case happens to be a postpartum case. So I know that. You folks didn't know that. But I just want you to be aware. Make sure you're presenting the case as an antepartum case unless it is purely a postpartum issue. Sorry, Melody. Go ahead. Carry on.
No worries. So she presented to the emergency room postpartum day 8 with vaginal bleeding. A few days prior, after her discharge, she did call the office on multiple occasions complaining of vaginal bleeding. She also did have a virtual visit, so 3 total visits prior to her emergency room visit. As the oncoming laborist the following day, she was already admitted and boarded for a DNC. Her workup had included a CBC, which showed a hemoglobin of 12.3, and an ultrasound that showed echogenic debris with 3 centimeters and internal vascularity. Upon my encounter of the patient prior to her surgery, she had minimal bleeding on her pad. She was... it was asymptomatic. I did perform the suction DNC as it was discussed with her previously and planned, and the pathology showed decidual endometrium with no chorionic villi. The reason why I wanted to present this case and ask about how to talk about it in the exam is because there was no chorionic villi seen, and this patient was counseled by myself that, you know, medical management may help in this situation versus surgical management, as she was stable, her exam was stable. However, the patient wanted surgery. So I wanted to see how I can tackle a question like, well, do you do surgery because the patient asked for it versus, you know,
sure,
how
sure.
would you so,
yeah,
manage?
This is a very important question because this is the kind of issue that everyone listening in can have to address in the exam. But before I answer your question directly, I first just want to bring up one issue. Folks, any of you who have a case like this, this one happens to be postpartum, but when a procedure, it can be OB typically, it can be GYN, but when a procedure is worked up for you and you're the one who sees the patient on the morning of surgery for the first time and you go ahead and do the procedure, there are 2 things you've got to be comfortable to say in the exam. Number 1, that you agree that this surgery is a reasonable treatment option for this patient. You know, don't be, I'm going to use a very strong word, but it's a little too strong. Don't be hooked, don't be conned into doing a surgery for a patient, for someone else who set it up, when you don't think it's the right decision. And if you've got a case like that on your list, you've got to be able to speak to that. And we're going to partially address that in this case, but it's not quite the same thing. The second point I want to make, in these cases where a patient is worked up for you and you just come in at the very end and do the surgery, it's your obligation as the surgeon to make sure that everything required for that workup has been done. Because you're putting your name to the management, you've got to be comfortable that it's all correct. Now, let's come to this specific case. And it is specific, and that's not really what's so important. There's a much bigger principle here. And in 99% of cases that any of you, some of you listening, will have this case, this kind of a case. In 99% of cases, what I'm going to tell you is exactly the correct approach, and that is just be totally open, honest in yourself. Excuse me, sorry. Just be totally open and honest. So, for example, Melody, I can agree with you that in this patient, there may be place for medical management, and we can argue there could be place for surgical management. Managing this patient prospectively, would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, and this is common to several of you out there listening in. Just because you get histology which doesn't support what you were expecting does not mean that the management was incorrect. You've got the advantage now of hindsight of seeing, well, the histology showed no trophoblastic villi. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's hindsight. We don't have that luxury when we're managing the patient's real-time life. So for you, Melody, as well as all the others who have a case of this kind of nature, the best thing is to be totally open and honest. And those of you who heard me present at the course, you would have heard me say, be open, be honest, and think aloud. So what do I mean by that? For example, Melody, in this case, if I were to role-play your situation, I would turn on to the examiner, present the case very briefly, and then say, when it came to management, I was of two minds. I could have tried to continue with conservative management, and I could have tried the surgical approach. The pros and cons of the medical approach were A, B, C, D, E. The pros and cons of a surgical approach were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I counsel for the patients on all the on all these options, and she was very much more comfortable to go with option X. In this case, it was surgery. But if you can just present it as such, exactly what you did and how you counseled the patient, the examiner is going to appreciate that you understand all the issues at hand here. And the fact that you didn't get villi at the end of the day is almost, from the exam point of view, totally inconsequential. So I wouldn't worry about this case at all. Be totally open and honest. In fact, I would start this case by saying this was an interesting case because this was a patient with suspected retained products of conception. I did a DNC and came back with no villi. That's how I would start, because that's showing the examiner, I'm not trying to hide, I'm not scared, I'm not timid. I'm taking the bull by the horns, and I'm dealing with the primary issue here. And it's okay. A very strong statement. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Thank you. That makes sense just going through it. And do you believe that the context of her coming to the office a few days prior and a virtual exam of concerns of bleeding,
yes,
is that relevant, or should I not?
She had been seen three times, including one virtual visit. It speaks to the need to go in a more aggressive route, in other words, surgery. They may well still ask, well, what was the conservative options of treatment that you reviewed with her? That's a fair question as well. But your management here is totally fine. I'm not one bit worried about it. Okay?
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you so much. That's great. Thank
excellent.
You.
You're welcome. Sure. All right. Zachary, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Thank you so much. All right, Zachary, we've got one, maybe two cases that we can go through. One, again, I've got your case on in the email that I received, but go ahead and present it very briefly, the first one, and let's talk about it.
So the first patient is a 33-year-old. She's a G4P3. She presented 6 weeks postoperatively, actually, for her post-op visit after a total laparoscopic hysterectomy with me and presented with worsening abdominal pain and distension for 48 hours and then had a...
It sounded like indigestion for 48 hours. Was that correct?
Worsening abdominal pain and distension.
Distension. Okay, fine. Sorry. Yeah.
And distension. Okay. 48 hours. And on just routine cuff check at that 6 week post op visit that she came to when she presented, she had what appeared to be like a mass or granulation tissue at the center of her vaginal cuff. Given her constellation of symptoms, I sent her for a CT of her abdomen and pelvis and identified free peritoneal air. On her CT. I consulted general surgery and suspected that she had at least partial vaginal cuff dehiscence, but couldn't rule out any other sort of visceral injury without an exploratory procedure. So I went in conjunction with general surgery and took this patient to the operating room for an exploratory laparoscopy where we identified there was no other intra-abdominal injuries or any sort of other unsurgical related perforated viscus, and then performed a repair of the vaginal cuff and a cystoscopy.
So this is a great exam case, folks. For those of you listening in, I hope you're trying to work out, if I was the examiner, what questions would I ask this candidate? So a couple of specifics and then a few general points. Firstly, specific questions. How long after a laparoscopy, for example, would you still expect to find air or gas in the abdomen?
You could typically expect it up to at least 72 to 96 hours.
Okay. And on the other side of the scale, look, I'm a generalist, okay? But my understanding is you shouldn't see gas after a week. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds reasonable.
The fact that you're 6 weeks out, if there is gas in the abdomen and she is distended, it's difficult to believe that she's coming from the bowel, because she would have been much more sick much sooner. Would you agree? You're suspecting there's a vulva dehiscence.
Mm-hmm.
Based on a presentation, I would argue you're probably right. Would you agree with that? Prospectively.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I also wanted to bring the general surgeon on board is because I didn't think that she necessarily had a delayed bowel injury, because, like you said, it was 6 weeks out from surgery. I was worried maybe she had a perforated duodenal ulcer, a perforated gastric ulcer, a perforated
I'm so pleased I brought this up. Because, folks, just and this goes to you as well, Zachary, obviously. Look what happened here. Zachary presented the case not mentioning, maybe you said it and I missed it, not mentioning a concern for possible concomitant incidental general surgery pathology. And it's only because I brought this up did we get to that issue. If I would not have brought it up, I, playing the role of the examiner, might have been left with the thought that this candidate doesn't know that gas 6 weeks out is always pathological. And why would he assume it's incidental, some general surgery? You need to mention that kind of information because it's relevant to your choosing to go in, okay? And I'm going to come back to this issue in just a moment. There's one other thing I want to address, though. In GYN, 95% of the time, the best modality of investigation is to do an ultrasound. In the absence of cancer, when you're looking at nodes, in the absence of cancer, an ultrasound is typically all that you need to look at. My question to you, Zachary, is could you not have gotten away with, you've got to defend the decision to do a CT, which is a much more expensive, involved procedure. Can you defend your decision to do a CT as opposed to an ultrasound? What would you say?
Yes. So in this patient, her constellation of abdominal distension, her abdominal pain on exam, her pelvic exam, the tender mass that was presenting at the center of her vaginal cuff that was either granulation tissue or, as it turned out, was actually a small piece of omentum that was plugging off her vaginal cuff, we found out later during the laparoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to have her undergo any sort of transvaginal imaging or ultrasound transvaginal imaging
Could you not have considered an abdominal probe?
I could have considered it, but an abdominal probe wouldn't have given me a better answer of what else is going on in terms of her abdominal distension and abdominal pain in terms of ruling out other non-GYN-related concerns.
Correct.
Yeah.
So look, the point that I want to make with this little interaction with Zachary is this. Virtually any time you order an MRI or a CT scan in GYN, you must be able to explain why an ultrasound wouldn't have been sufficient. Okay? And Zachary was able to do that very nicely. Next point. Why did you choose to do a laparotomy? Couldn't you have done a laparoscopy?
We're
attacking every decision point here, and that's what they'll do in the exam. It's totally legitimate, and you shouldn't feel threatened by it, but go ahead, Zachary.
So I did do a laparoscopy. I did an exploratory laparoscopy.
I thought you said laparotomy. I'm sorry.
I actually did this, and you may have missed this on my original presentation. I don't know if my cell service is breaking up or what. I actually consulted general surgery for co-management of this as soon as I identified the peritoneal free air or concern for other non-GYN pathologies, and we went to the operating room with this patient together to perform a joint.
Joint
exploratory laparoscopy for her. As soon as we identified laparoscopically that there was no GI or general surgery pathology and that this was a 50% vaginal cuff dehiscence, the case was turned over entirely to me and I did the vaginal cuff repair.
Good. There are two more questions that I want to just raise here. Number one, this is not the exact case, but it's the principle that I want to bring out to everyone. If you think you may have, and some of you have this on your cases, you may have a post-op complication. There may be distension, bowel changes. You're concerned for possible bowel injury. We really want to avoid doing a laparotomy in such a situation with all the morbidity that's associated with it. We'd much rather just put in a scope and take a look. But I want to caution you folks, if you, for those who have this kind of a case on your list, if in the differential diagnosis, before going back in again, you've got bowel injury. And you're taking the case back to yourself on your own. The question is, why are you doing a laparoscopy? Because, and it's a trap you can set for yourself inadvertently. If, as is the case with 99% of us, if you're not comfortable to run the bowel laparoscopically, then you shouldn't be doing it as a scope. As much as the intent to be as least morbid as possible is a good one, you're actually doing the wrong procedure. You need to, if you're concerned for possible bowel injury and you can't get a general surgeon to go in with you, as Zachary did, and you can't run the bowel on your own laparoscopically, then you need to open the patient. And I just wanted to make sure that all of you are aware of that issue. Don't fall into that trap, okay? Because they can argue you're doing the wrong surgery, or at least the wrong entry into the abdomen. The next point is specific. And any of you who have anything on your case list that remotely resembles a possible vault dehiscence, you've got to be able to discuss, number one, the options of closing or not closing, and when you keep it open, do you rim it? How do you rim it? When you close it, how do you close it? If the hysterectomy was done for prolapse, what do you do surgically when closing the vault to prevent prolapse of the vault at a subsequent time? And also, you've got to, this is a tough one, well, not just, you folks aren't going to like this, you've got to be prepared to talk about bladder and ureteric injuries. Because when closing the vault, if you take bites which are too deep anteriorly, you can get into bladder and you would be very close to trigone. And if you take too big a bite laterally, you can potentially involve the ureters or kink the ureters or tie off the ureters. So you've got to be able to discuss at what point in the course of the ureter and in what points of doing the C-section are the ureters most commonly damaged. Okay? And that's the only other question, Zachary, that I can think of that would be relevant for you. Have I answered the question that you've got?
I just wanted to, you know, talk through possible things that, you know, I could be asked about it. This was definitely, you know, a case that was, it was very odd that she dehisced at 6 weeks. but she had risk factors associated with it. She was a smoker, she had a very low BMI.
Is she obese? Is she immunocompromised? Does she have weak tissues? Does she have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, for example? The obvious thing that you have to consider is how long do you counsel a patient post-hysterectomy before she indulges in intercourse again? Because that probably is one of the more common causes of vault dehiscence 6 weeks out or 4 weeks out. So was that a possibility in this case?
So I counsel my patients actually 8 weeks, and that's because I had took care of a couple patients in residency that had cuff dehiscences, and so I'm on the conservative side with that in my practice. But this patient actually had not, because I counsel them that there's nothing in the vagina until I've cleared them, at least at their 6 week post-op for sure. And so she had not had anything in the vagina. In her case,
just be comfortable
she primarily
to mention
had
that,
issue.
And the other thing that I would add is you can counsel patients, and it's nice to say this in the exam, just because it shows the examiner you are very practically oriented. And that is, you might want to advise them when they have an intercourse for the first time or second or third time that she should sit on top of her partner. That way she controls the depth of penetration as opposed to her lying on her back, she's got more control and would be less likely to result in increased pressure on the vault. You know, one doesn't have to be vulgar and crude, but it is practical. And I think it comes across very well in the exam. It shows the examiner you're very practically oriented, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Yeah, your question?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Zachary, we can take very quickly your second case, if you want to present it briefly and what the issue is for you.
The second case, she was a 24-year-old G1 P0. She ended up undergoing a primary cesarean section at 38 weeks and 5 days for a persistent Category 2 fetal tracing. And then she also had a concomitant left adnexal mass at 11 centimeters that was identified around 35 weeks of gestation. That had been evaluated with MRI and in consultation with gynecologic oncology did not require formal referral per their notes. And then during cesarean delivery, she desired removal of this mass. And given there's no appreciable ovarian tissue at the time, we performed a left oophorectomy at time of her cesarean delivery. That was really the part I wanted to discuss.
What, doing the left oophorectomy?
Yeah, just because I know there's some controversy about doing an oophorectomy or removing adnexal mass at time of cesarean delivery just because of the increased vascularity and risk of bleeding.
Correct, correct.
I know there's an argument. Split on this.
Yes. There's an argument to come back and take it subsequently or take it all at one time. The way I would handle this in the exam, again, is to think aloud, folks. Do this. It helps you out tremendously. I would say in the exam, and I counseled her as such, I was going to, there are a couple of basic principles. Number one, I will not do a C-section just in order to remove an adnexal mass. The decision to do a C-section is based purely on OB principles. So that's point number one. Point number two, I told her, if I land up doing a C-section, which subsequently happened, I will take a look at the ovary. Typically, we don't want to dissect out a cyst in pregnancy because there's going to be increased bleeding. And there's an increased risk that she may land up with an oophorectomy. I counseled her on this. Not only was she okay with this, but she very much wanted this removed and was comfortable with the idea. And I told her, look, it depends on what the anatomy of that ovary looks like at the time. And when I looked at it and assessed it, as is typically the case, very difficult to do a cystectomy or a partial oophorectomy without getting into significant bleeding. And the anatomy was such that if I was going to remove it, I was going to have to take the whole ovary. I looked at the contralateral ovary just to make sure that it was normal, which it was. And at that point, for this 12.5-centimeter mass, I went and removed the entire ovary, and it turned out to be X, Y, or Z, whatever it is.
It's a benign
cyst. How does that sound to you, Zachary?
Yeah,
sorry?
No, that's exactly what my plan was to say, and that's exactly how the counseling for this patient went.
Perfect.
I've just had some people tell me, like, oh, yeah, you really, you know, it's really not recommended to do that, and so that's why I wanted to bring this up and have your input.
Give both schools of thought. And, folks, look, every one of you have these kind of cases where it can go one of two ways or one of three ways, and you decided this way versus that way. It's okay. Just be able to say, you know, these are the pros and cons. This is how I counseled the patient. This is what I found, and this is what I did, and this is the reason why. Think aloud. I've said this many times at courses. I say it again. Think aloud, okay? You'll do superbly well. And at the end of the day, I mean, I just went on basic principles here. And look, Zachary pretty much confirmed that's exactly what he did. Because it is the most appropriate thing to do. So I want you to be comfortable to handle these kind of complications this way. It's really the best way to do it. Take the bull by the horns, as I said earlier. Okay? So, Zachary, you're okay with that? Yes?
Yes. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. You're more than welcome. All right, folks. We're almost out of time. Just wanted to say we're going to lose another 25% before we do this next time round. So those taking the exam in 10 days or whatever it is, I want to wish you all the best of luck. We want to hear from you folks the good news that you were successful. Please get back in touch with us. And I'd also say again, as I said at the course, if you found that exam has been helpful, please tell your colleagues about us. We really, really would appreciate that. Those taking the exam next year or the subsequent years, that'll be great. So with that being said, our next teleseminar I've got here is just 2 weeks' time, the 29th of October. The 29th of October, we'll do this all again. I want to encourage you to volunteer. And just by the way, I'm doing this for a reason. I'm going to get back to everyone. Miriam, are you there?
I'm here.
Miriam, you still there? Can you be honest? I didn't interact with you that much, but did you find this helpful? Be honest.
I thought it was helpful to listen to the other two candidates and how to address some of the complicated cases.
Yeah, because there's more interaction there. Your question was just a basic knowledge question, an informational question. I shouldn't say knowledge, an informational question. Okay, fair enough. Melody, how about you? Are you there, Melody?
I'm here. Thank you so much. That was very helpful.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. And Zachary, you how did you find it? Worthwhile?
Yeah, I thought it was very helpful. Thank you.
All right, sure. And I do this because those of you that have not volunteered, I want you to volunteer. It's a great opportunity. And if you feel embarrassed, there's no need to. You noticed I only used their first names. I don't even have their last names. So no one will know if you get a question wrong that who you are, because you remain anonymous. And it's good practice, and it's good to experience this before you walk into the exam and not for the first time in the exam. So to Miriam, Melody, and Zachary, I really appreciate it. There were some good cases that you presented, and we're all good. So, folks, that's it. Again, all the best of luck to you, and we'll touch base again in 2 weeks' time. This then concludes our teleconference. Thanks again, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.